radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
All right, well, good morning, and welcome to Firehouse Expo here in beautiful Baltimore, and we're just happy to be here this morning. We're going to talk a little bit about basement fires and some of the unique situations that we can get involved with in basement fires. On the panel this morning, my name is Russ Merrick. I'll be hosting the panel. I have John, Robert, or Bob, as he likes to be called, Nick, Dave, and Mike, and we're going to try and answer any questions that some of you may have, and we're going to try and give you some of the information that we have brought up over the years. A little background myself. My name is, like I said, Russ Merrick. I'm from Rochester, New York. I'm a company officer there as a captain, and I've held several positions from safety officer to special operations to training, and right now I'm a covering officer on the line for our guys there in Rochester. I have a master's degree in emergency management, a bachelor's degree in fire protection, and an associate's degree in fire protection. So more in the book end of it than probably I should have been. But I'll have our other panelists here introduce themselves and a little bit about their background. Mike?
Good morning. My name is Mike Daly, 24 years in the fire service. I'm a lieutenant, Monroe Township, assigned to Ladder 8. I'm also an instructor at Middlesex County Fire Academy, develop courses for fire and rescue curriculum, and I'm a rescue officer with New Jersey Task Force 1, Urban Search and Rescue.
Dave?
Captain Dave Fornell. I'm from, right now, Cassetown, Ohio, just outside of Dayton. Been in the fire service about 40 years. Was a captain, retired as a captain off the Danbury, Connecticut Fire Department. Wrote a book, Fire Stream Management, about water movement. Do a lot of teaching around the country. You kind of bring some of the, I'm a Chicago boy, so bringing some maybe Midwest influence in there. But I'm also an honorary battalion chief of the FDNY. So we'll kind of try to get maybe a little rural experience as well as city stuff here.
Okay, Nick.
Good morning. My name is Nick Martin. First, thanks for the opportunity to be here. I've been in the fire service, I guess, about 15 or so years now. Started as a firefighter just outside of Philadelphia, where I grew up. I'm presently a firefighter in the District of Columbia Fire Department, assigned to a truck company, and a volunteer in Prince George's County, Maryland, with the Kentland Volunteer Fire Department. And I also do a lot of instruction around the country, traveling with a group called Traditions Training, doing a lot of this type of thing and some hands-on stuff. I'm very happy to be here this morning.
Okay. And Bob.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for having me here. Bob Moran, I'm the fire chief in the city of Englewood in Bergen County, New Jersey. Been in the fire service for 32 years, chief for 12. I do have a master's degree, took the formal education route like our friend Russ, and I'm a member of the New Jersey Urban Search and Rescue Team like Michael is. I'm a safety officer on the team. And basement fires has been something that my partner and I have been teaching for several years now. Took an interest in that in about 2004 after we almost lost three firefighters in a basement fire in the city of Englewood. We're here to hopefully learn from you and give you some good information.
And last but not least, John.
Good morning, everybody. My name is John Lewis. I'm a lieutenant in the city of Passaic, New Jersey. Fire department assigned to the engine company. I've been in the fire service about 30 years. Both career and volunteer. I'm teaching at the County Fire Academy, and I do some travel and training with my partner here also. We have done a program on called It's in the Basement, and we passed this information along before, and I think it's really important. Everybody I talk to about basement fires always has piques interest. I just spoke to Art over here in the audience, and right away, you know, he's had problems with his jurisdiction. Everybody in the room probably has. And it's something we need to be aware of, the dangers of the inherent buildings that we don't.
Okay, and what we want to get started right away here on is we want to talk a little bit about the inherent dangers of basement fires. And as all of us know in the fire service, basement fires are probably the most dangerous types of fires for us to get involved with. So I'll go back. I'll start with John again. John, why don't you talk a little bit about some of the dangers associated with basement fires?
All right, well, one of the biggest dangers associated with basement fires is trying to ensure that the fire is, find out that the fire is below you. You know, you're crawling around on that first floor, you get a lot of heat, you get a lot of smoke, and you don't realize you're on the floor above the fire right away, as soon as you make entry into the building. Now you found the access way to the basement, you have that decision to make now. Do I go down, do I stay up? What's the incident commander gonna do? Is he gonna pull us out? What's our lead time? And then when we do try and make those basements, we try and make it down those stairs, what type of stairway is it? Is it an open stairway, is it a closed stairway? Is it a protected stairway? Is it a door at the top, a door at the bottom? There's so many different variables there just making the basement stairs that even once you get into the basement with the storage configurations, Collier's Mansion type that you find there, just regular open joist construction, truss construction, not knowing the buildings that we're going to, not having the opportunity to see the inside of what makes up every building is one of our biggest problems. The building construction is not our friend, as we know, and you have to be aware of that.
Yeah, and you mentioned the locating of the fire, not knowing the exact location when we get there, and then finding out that the fire is, in fact, below us. One of the other factors that's involved there is access. Usually we have only one or two ways to get into our basements. It's either through an interior stairwell or an exterior stairwell. And why don't we talk a little bit about that, Bob?
Obviously, locating the access to the lower grade areas becomes very important. One of the things that you have to worry about also, Russ, is air management. You know, we enter in the front door and we actually have to search for the access to that area. So how long are we in these buildings for before we actually find the door down into that below grade area? And preparation before we make access to that area. You know, do you have water in the line? Is a line charge? Are you ready for when that door is open for that environment to come up the stairs at you? You know, and at that point, you have to be ready at that point to make that push down the stairs. You know, you have to decide beforehand. You can't stop in the stairs. If you stop in the stairs, you're going to get yourself injured or hurt, and the fire is going to overcome you. So being ready when you find that access point after searching throughout that house for that below grade area access becomes very important.
And like Bob was saying, one of the things is once you find that access point, getting down the stairs, you need to get down the stairs as quickly as possible, because if you think of it in the form of a chimney, basically is what you're doing is going down a chimney flue to get to the fire. You're getting an awful lot of heat, the gases, the smoke, they're trying to leave the area of the basement. Bob mentioned air management. We have very limited access for ventilation in our basement fires. Some buildings today that we can get into, they won't even have windows in them. For security reasons, or if they had windows in them, they blocked them out, so you can't perform ventilation. So that stairwell acts as the chimney for that fire to try and ventilate the built-up heat, smoke, and gases, and it's trying to ventilate out while you're trying to get down to it. So it's crucial that once you start that descent down that stairwell, you got to be quick about it. What are some of the other dangers that we have once we do make access down there as far as protection of our hose line, Nick?
Just real quick before we get to that, a couple things that I've just been thinking about as we listen to some of the others here. The size up, as you kind of said, that's the immediate thing. I was saying a day before we started here that the problem with basement fires isn't necessarily the basement fire itself. I mean, once we know that we have that, we have options, and if we plan ahead, we have things we can do. It's the big problem is that if you look at a lot of the tragedies that have occurred, the main issue is nobody figured out it was a basement fire until it was too late. And that's all too often is happening. You know, somebody's starting to go through the floor, or the classic, we're on the first floor, it's hot, and we can't find the fire. You know, anytime we enter a building, we have to, if we have conditions on a floor, we have to assume that conditions came from below that floor until proven otherwise. And from a size up perspective, one of the things I learned very quickly as a company officer in the county was the beware the house with smoke from everywhere. You know, when you pull up and you've got fire blowing out the front bay window, fire's in the living room, we know that. But when you pull up and you have fire or you have smoke conditions kind of loosely coming from possibly everywhere, I mean, that's got to be a dead key that it's in. I mean, maybe it's not in the basement, but from a safety perspective and from an operational success perspective, we have to assume that the fire is in the basement until proven otherwise. And a couple of things that we've developed to...
And just to... jump on that a little bit, too. Another key indicator that you may possibly have a basement fire is if when you pull up, you see smoke coming from the structure's chimney, because that's another flue, another avenue for the smoke and gases to release from, and it's going to occupy everything in the basement, including the furnace, and it's going to want to try and vent. Sometimes you'll pull up if you see smoke ventilating out of the chimney in July. Mm-hmm. It's usually not a common sight, so you probably ought to start thinking basement fire right away.
Absolutely, and kind of, the two primary organizations that I'm involved with, Prince George's County Fire Department and the District of Columbia, both have, sadly, a very tragic recent history of basement fires. I was saying to some of the guys, our last three operational line-of-duty deaths in Washington were all from basement fires. Another one of them killed two firefighters, another killed one, and the one that killed two also critically injured a third. And in Prince George's County, I had the unfortunate opportunity to be involved in a very, very close near miss that critically injured one of our firefighters. And the department as a whole has had a couple other incidents, their last operational line of duty death also being in a basement fire. And one of the two things that come up with that are the size up factor and the steps. In the fire that killed Anthony Phillips and Lewis Matthews on Cherry Road Northeast in Washington, D.C., one of the primary issues was ventilation and the steps. And I'm sure we'll get into some of those issues later on, but to make a long story short, when the windows were ventilated in the basement without ventilation on the first floor, basically a column of fire shot up the stairs at about 15 to 20 miles an hour and overwhelmed the firefighters on the first floor. And that kind of goes in what you're kind of saying about, you know, you're basically climbing down the chimney to go put these fires out. And I got to tell you, that's our last thing we'll do. There's basically three methods of attack that we have. It's very organized and regimented and laid out in an SOP. And I think that's important because, as we were kind of alluding to earlier, a lot of times there's confusion. Maybe we're not running basement fires all the time. There are a lot of variables. There are a lot of options for attack. And if everybody is not on the same page with that off the get-go, that's where the snowball starts rolling down the hill and we end up with the calamity errors that get somebody hurt or killed. So our last option is going down the steps. But as far as, you know, when that option does come up, and that was one of the things that happened on 68th Place, which was a fire that I was involved with that critically injured one of our firefighters, put him in the burn center for about 3 months with respiratory injuries. It was, make a long story short, a gas-fed fire, the internal gas meter, the lines had burned through, and there was walls of fire down in the basement. And it was a compartmentalized basement. It was kind of like a laundry room. It wasn't really like an officially finished style basement. But this fire is going on behind a couple of walls that are partially burned through, and they're preventing us from getting a line on it. I think we had a 2-inch line down in the basement. And there was one point after our firefighter gotten burned, and there was some communication, a miscommunication about whether or not he'd gotten out. A couple of us basically made the steps on our bellies and made it down in the basement. We're trying to push this line on the fire. And one of the things that happened in relation to your question about protecting that hose line is as we were going around one side of this kind of compartmentalized, like utility-style room, trying to put the fire out, not really knowing at the time about the gas, it was coming out the other side and kind of cutting us off. So we're doing three things at once, trying to go this way to put the fire out, trying to go this way to keep from getting cut off, and trying to look for the guy that we still think is trapped in the basement burning up. And that brings up one of the hazards that I think about the steps is, and this is what I always say to guys, that I don't think that the problem is getting down the steps, because to be honest, if you can make it down the steps, it's not that bad. The problem is, once you get down the steps, can you make it back out? If you went down the steps, and at least the way we do things, that was our only way in. So clearly then it's also our only way out. So if things get worse, now, you know, we're climbing up the chimney, which is just as bad, if not worse, as going down. And in the scenario where we have to, you know, we're not just going down the bottom of the steps and fighting fire, like say we're taking that line and going 10, 15 into another room in the basement, another section of the basement, we're leaving that 10, 15 foot gap between our exit and the nozzle. And in a scenario like happened to me on 68th Place, when that fire comes around, comes out somewhere else, it stands a good chance of cutting off your exit and burning through your hose line simultaneously. So, you know, in that kind of scenario, when you do have somebody going down the steps and advancing past the bottom of the steps, you got to make sure that a backup line gets down there also and basically protects the entrance back to the steps for them to get back out.
just like a normal structure fire, our first line always goes to the interior stairwell. In this case here, for firefighters, it would be that interior cellar stairwell. Dave, I want to like you to talk a little bit. Nick touched on once they've gotten to the basement, moving and getting around in the basement because of layout and whatnot. Why don't you talk a little bit about some of the dangers or the conditions that we may find in the basement?
Well, one of the things I think it all starts with a size up. You've got to do a 360. Two firefighters were lost a little over a year ago in Coleraine Township, Ohio, near me. They pulled up. The people said the fire was in the basement. They took a hose line in. It wasn't charged. They were trying to get the hose line charged. It ended up that the floor gave way. It was lightweight construction. So one of the dangers is definitely when you size up, you better be sure that that construction is going to be able to hold you how long the fire was burning. Because they didn't do a 360, they didn't realize that there was an external or an exterior entrance to the basement, which would have been a lot easier to push a line in there than down the stairs. And when they finally, the floor collapsed, they went down in the basement. There was some radio confusion. They finally got a line down there. A couple of lines. They put the fire out, found the victims, DOA. One of the things that brought up that in that fire, they actually had a pot growing operation down there. And that was in a separate room. That was in a crawl space. So here they had an entire vented crawl space. It had lights in there. It was wired with bare wires. And so there's a lot of, you know, entanglement hazards. They had nothing to do with the primary cause of death. But I think going back to this, number one, you've got to do a 360. If there is an outside entrance, which we find a lot in outlying areas, that may be where you want to make the point of attack. Secondly, in moving that line downstairs, you've got to have the people to do it. I think the backup line, as Nick was saying, I think is very important. So if you push a line downstairs with two people, there's nobody upstairs, there's not another line coming in, you've got a problem. Unfortunately, a lot of basement fires are in single-family dwellings. And as you know, people can chop these dwellings up. I had a fire early in my career. It was in a one-story ranch house with a full basement. And we were getting heavy, heavy, black, thick smoke coming out of the basement. We couldn't figure it out. And we couldn't get down the stairs. There was intense heat coming up the stairs. The chief ordered us to take the picture windows out in the living room. We used a saw and we cut a big vent hole in the floor. So this fire was venting up through the floor, out this window. We were finally able to get downstairs. And what we found out is the homeowner had actually finished the basement. It was a finished basement. And when he was putting, you know, there was no windows down there. And he actually furred out the walls about 2.5 feet. And he put his paneling up there so he had storage behind there. And what was actually burning was about 3 sets of snow tires. And again, we couldn't figure out the black smoke. But some of the dangers you see down there, you know, we were facing this tremendous, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face, smoke. So you had the vent. There's an old adage a battalion chief told me. He says, when he pulls up, he says the first thing he does if he's got a basement fire, he gets the roof. And for that, you know, for the reason is that, as Nick was saying, if you've got to really watch your air management here, you've got to be able to vent that first floor. It's going to be untenable real quick. If the fire does get loose and gets in the walls in some of these older buildings, it's going right to the roof. So there again, you're talking an awful lot of people. You're talking an awful lot of management. You're talking, as you were saying, Russ, is a you've got an area in that basement that you really don't know how cut up it is. Chicago had a fire about 3 years ago. It was a basement fire. It was in a four-story apartment building. Luckily, it was 2 p.m. The basement was wide open. But it was partitioned off with chicken wire and 2x4 storage areas. Some kids were playing with matches. The whole basement lit off. It got all the stairwells packed up. And they picked like 30 people off the ladders in that particular case. And I mean, luckily it was 2:30 p.m. If it was at night, there probably would have been some fatalities. So there was a basement that was totally wide open. And they had problems with that because that fire spread so quickly and it went right up the stairwells on both sides. So again, one of the big dangers, I think, in basement fires is that, as you were saying, totally unknown layout. And so you've really got to be careful when you size this thing up. You may want to take a window out and hit the fire from the outside just to break its back. I'm not saying that that's what you should do all the time. You've got to hold the basement stairs to keep it from coming up, but you might want to break the back of that fire before you run a line down there. But
I'll just jump in here because this has happened to me. If you have firefighters that have already made an attack on that fire or have started their ascent into that basement, you don't want to be sticking a line in an outside window.
Absolutely.
I've had that happen, and I'll tell you, the first guy I'm looking for when I come out of that basement is the guy that did that, because I'm going to kill him.
Absolutely. No, absolutely not. Not when there's people going down the stairs. You've got to coordinate that attack.
But we've heard a couple of things here already. And
Russ,
yes, sir.
Just one second. One thing I want to add to that. In today's economy, I don't know how your towns or cities are. I know that where I work, we have a lot of day laborers in our city. Houses, private dwellings, we find 15 to 20 people in some of the private dwellings. In Jersey, we call it stacking. We call them illegal occupancies. We had a fire around the corner from the firehouse about 3 years ago where we had 3 fatalities in the basement. They had removed the basement stairs, the only access out up into the second floor, and the fire was right at the basement access, the exterior access. So the line had to go in that door. There was no other access to the basement, and the 3 people were found in that hallway, because that was their only way out. The basement had been divided up into 4 apartments. So, you know, maybe with your fire prevention bureau, you're out there, you're doing your district checks, little signs to look for, you know, 4 satellite dishes on the outside of a private dwelling, 6 cars in the driveway.
10 to 12 bicycles.
10 to 12 bicycles chained up outside. You know, when you drive by a house and you see those kind of signs, an electrical cord running maybe up, you know, from the first floor down into the basement, air conditioners in the basement, those are things that you got to look out for. So the size up, like Dave is saying, becomes very, very important.
Yeah, we've talked about size up, and twice we've hit that. So obviously size up is key to anything we do in the fire service. That's what gives us our abilities to start putting some strategies together to implement our tactics. So one thing that we've been talking about, and it seems to be one of the more prevalent things in today's society, is our manpower situation. We talked about deploying that second line or movement of lines, and it takes manpower. I'm going to have Mike talk a little bit about manpower, and the key to any operation is the number of firefighters that we can get on location.
Real basically, here's the thing. I don't care really where the fire is. I've identified 6 things that have to happen during any interior structural fire, whether it's a cellar fire, basement fire, first floor, second floor, attic, doesn't matter. There's 6 things that have to happen. Number one, we have to have somebody in charge. So we're losing one person to the commander. Secondly, we have to get in the building. Whether it's forcible entry, hooded door, however we're getting in, we have to get in. We've got to get water on the fire. Now, I'm a big advocate of a minimum of 2 lines, but I push 3 lines into a basement or a cellar fire. So I have to have enough personnel to man the lines and get water from a hydrant. Or, in our case, a third of our district is non-hydrated. So our personnel have to be pretty good at tanker operations and get water relatively quick. Next, we have to do search. We have to have people for search. And the rule of thumb is 2 people for every 2,000 square foot of floor space that they're going to cover. So if you look at your jurisdiction and where I'm at, the presidential estates, you're talking residential dwellings of 6,000, 7,000 square feet. So you're losing a whole truck just to do search. After that, somebody's got to vent. Somebody has to be able to open up so that the engine company's not taking a beat and going down the stairs, and we have to coordinate all that. And finally, I got to have a RIC team standing by, rapid intervention crew standing by. I get the whole 2 in, 2 out, but in New Jersey, legislation is now being pushed that the minimum amount of personnel to stand by on a RIC team is 4. And quite honestly, I don't think 4 does it, but it's a step in the right direction. When you add all this up, 2 lines, somebody doing search, somebody doing ventilation, an incident commander, and getting us water, you're very easily up around 20 personnel. Now, I don't know anybody that's moving 20 firefighters on the first alarm by themselves. We're doing it because we have automatic aid agreements with surrounding municipalities on a confirmed structure fire that they're coming. That's the only way we'd be able to do it. But the big thing to identify is that of these 6 vital tasks that go on in a fire ground, if you don't have the manpower, one of those tasks is not getting done. And really, I don't think any of those 6 tasks can be afforded to be ignored in the first 10 to 15 minutes of the alarm.
Okay. What I would like to do right now, we've got a sizable group here. If anybody in the audience here have questions you'd like to ask pertaining to basement fires or anything that you'd like us to expound upon that we touched on here this morning so far. Yes, sir.
Does anybody have any experience using the old cellar nozzles?
It's funny you mentioned that. I was going to bring that up when we talk a little bit more on some of the tactic stuff, is the direct attack and foam operations. We can use foam. We could, obviously, if things get really bad, we go to master streams. But I'm going to put you in my category. You must be one of the dinosaurs in the fire service, because in my city, I haven't seen a cellar pipe on a piece of apparatus in the last 7 years. It seems like we're getting all this other high-tech equipment. We got to find space. Cabinet space on our apparatus is at a minimal. And some of the things that go are those tools that we haven't used in a long time. The cellar pipe, gooseneck applicators, those things have long found the closet in my firehouse. So, great tool. Cellar pipe, I've also, in my career, I've used it for attic fires. Can't get into an attic real quick because you got a heck of a fire going there. Just throw it down into one of those vent louvers. Let the thing go, darken it down, get your guys up there. But, yeah, it's a great tool to be used. Again, does everybody know what we're talking about? All right, good.
If I can jump in here, Russ, I've used them on fires. And we're talking about, I think, the Bresnan nozzle. It spins. Okay. A couple of things. You probably only use it once in your career, but when you use it, it's the only thing that's going to work. It throws water in a circular pattern. The bigger the nozzle, and I would suggest don't get an inch and a half if you're going to buy one, get a 2.5. Flows about 300 gallons a minute. It'll spray about 60 feet out, but it also sprays up. It gets the floor underneath. To utilize the thing, you need to put the nozzle on the end, 50 feet of hose and a shutoff. Otherwise, you're going to get wet. It's going to be a mess. You've got to get a truck to cut a hole in the floor. You got to get a hole cut in the floor big enough to drop it. You drop it all the way in. You feed the hose down until you hear it hit the floor, then you pull it back up, and so you run it back and forth. You're going to need about 3 or 4 people to run that thing. And then when steam starts coming up out of the hole, then it's time to move it. And where to cut the hole, you've got to have time to do it. I would not recommend it in these residential occupancies with lightweight construction. You just may not have the time to get it in the right spot. But again, if you get a fire, you can't get to the fire, for whatever reason, you think you know where it is, you cut a hole in the floor, you see orange down there, drop that thing in, it works fine. But there again, it takes an awful lot of practice to use it. And if it's on the rig, it makes a nice drill, so I take it and everybody gets wet. We had a fire in Danbury in the basement of a furniture store. And it was actually about 3 or 4 old stores on Main Street that were going. There was no stopping it. It was going up. My size up was that we're going to lose the building. It's going to collapse in about 2 hours. I mean, it was that far gone. And then one of the younger officers on the department said, can you use the cellar nozzle through that window? Well, you don't use it horizontally. We had to explain to him you have to use it vertically, but the floor was untenable on the first floor. But it does work. And again, some of us old dinosaurs that have used it, once you use it, if it's used in the right spot, nothing else will work like it.
Hey, Russ?
Good question, yes. Absolutely.
It's a great tool to use, but where are we using that tool? We're on the floor above the fire. Mm-hmm. So you set the tool, you have to stay there with it, right? Because you have to be able to operate it. So you pay attention to how long the fire has been burning underneath that floor area that you're now operating on, and can you actually, like Dave said, becomes untenable at times. So you have to really weigh those factors in also if you're going to put the tool to work.
And again, it comes back to building construction, like Dave was saying, too. You don't want to be worrying about trying to get in there. If it's lightweight construction and a fire's really got a good hold in the basement, we got issues.
Yeah, and when that was invented, around the turn of the 1900s.
Didn't you invent that, Dave?
No, I didn't. I can't take credit for that one. The steamer that ran it,
Okay.
But understand when these gooseneck cellar pipes and all that, and we'll take New York City at the time, they could have 4 engine companies on that line. I mean, if they had a fire in a basement, they had heavy timber construction, ordinary type construction. They had a fire in a basement or second sub basement, and they may have had 150 people on the scene. So you could grab enough people to cut the hole, stand there, have another line right next to it, work it up and down. Nowadays, you know, it's like, what's Russ going to tell me to do? You know, so it's a little different nowadays. But if the conditions are right, the construction has to be right. Again, you've got to manage that floor above the fire, and if you're, you know, and you've got to put it in the right spot.
I just would like to go back again. Has anybody got another question? That was a great question. Yes, sir.
Well, my thought is, I'm thinking the sink and this guy, this was all pretty old construction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, this gentleman over here is dealing with everything from the stuff from 1980 on. Real concrete block versus maybe 4-inch wall. But what's the difference in tactics? How much water will he absorb as compared to these guys? Or how much heat will this guy absorb compared to these guys as far as heat production?
Can I take that?
My city is a very old city. It was built, organized in the early 1800s, we just celebrated our 220-something anniversary. And not a lot of our buildings have changed. We've got a lot of old Queen Anne's, Queen Victorians, balloon frame structures in our city. Like you said, we're a very older mill city, whereas opposed to where Mike is from, more of a modern New Jersey. Right? Not far from me, maybe what, an hour tops?
Yeah, if that.
A whole other world. In construction wise, our fires, we're realizing that we're pulling up, we got balloon frame buildings right off the bat. You know, like Dave said, yeah, and Nick said, you got to get upstairs. You open up downstairs, you're going to shoot that fire upstairs. You know, ventilation is one of the key things, of, no matter what, any type of fire you go to. But knowing your construction, knowing your buildings you're going to, our buildings may be a little stronger than Mike's down the other end. You know, they may last a little longer. It may give us that extra advantage to get inside and cut a hole in the floor where the lightweight construction now.
Can I embellish
Mike?
On that? Yeah. Here's the problem with construction as I see it. And I have a kind of a hodgepodge of both, but I'm primarily a lot more newer construction. Nowadays, buildings are being built with half the material, spanning twice the distance, holding twice the fire load. The problem that we have is the biggest knock as fast as we can. I will not rule out using a Bresnan distributor in that type of dwelling, but I better have a really good handle on what's going on in that cellar.
You better have the manpower available.
And again, yeah, I know I beat up the manpower before. The thing is, everything works coincide. If I'm throwing a Bresnan distributor in a cellar, somebody's got the Bilco doors ready to vent. It all has to work in unison. It has to. You know, it's a shame, but sometimes there's just things that are beyond your control, too. So.
But conventional construction versus lightweight construction is obviously going to give us more time. Yeah.
And Art, as you know, I mean, if you deal with lightweight construction, okay, we don't put people on the roof as quickly as we used to. I mean, you've got to really evaluate what's going on up there. The basement. I mean, Hinsdale, Illinois, almost lost a fireman. He did a 360, realized the fire was in the basement. He was looking for the entrance, went through the living room floor in a house under construction. There was no load, you know. And so, I mean, lightweight construction, yeah, it fails quickly, fails without warning. And so, you know, it may end up being that, you know, what do you do with any lightweight constructed building or a building that has trusses? You've really got to do a risk analysis. If that's a heavy fire, it's in there, we may just do an exterior attack. I mean, but that's something you can only tell when you do your sizing.
Mike wants to add one more thing.
You know, we're spending a lot of time on residential dwellings. I know 90% of the fires we fight in the fire service are residential dwellings, but we can't ignore the commercial dwelling. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the issues with commercial dwellings and commercial occupancies is the stairwell door may not be vertical. The stairwell door might be a hatchway with two stringers and a couple of treads coming across. It might take you longer to find the hatchway to the cellar than it would be to cut a hole in the floor and put a cellar nozzle in. So don't discount that for the commercial occupancy as well. Yeah. Now, I know we're talking a lot about residential, but there are some really good applications for that cellar nozzle and that Bresnan. And commercial dwellings, if you can't make the stairs in the first few minutes, without question, feel free to think about that as long as the floor will hold it.
I'm sure we'll get into it, but as far as commercial dwellings, what size line are you stretching? We go to a commercial building fire and we're stretching a 2.5-inch hand line.
Absolutely.
You know, we use 2-inch hand lines for our pre-connect residential fires. We have anywhere from 8 to 13 people on duty, just like every fire department around the country can't put as many people as FDNY can in the street. So you get your biggest bang for your buck. Greatest GPM, you want to put on a fire as quickly as possible, as Mike is saying. So it becomes important with the type of line
to stretch. GPM puts the fire out. I had another question here.
What's like attic versus a cock loft and the definition between the two? What is the panel's definition of a cellar and what is the panel's definition of a basement?
Can I?
Yes.
Okay, there's textbook definitions out there for various books, and it basically goes by height level that's above grade or below grade. I do have it here.
Cellars are usually mostly below grade, if I can
below
add
grade,
to that.
Yeah.
You know, and the easiest way that I find spot the difference is really the size of the window in the two. Mm-hmm. If you look like you have closer to a full-size window, most of it's above grade, that's going to be a basement. Smaller windows are a cellar, really pain in the neck to vent. And construction-wise, they're going to be different, too. Stairwell-wise, in the cellar, if you have two stringers and a set of treads, that's probably what you have. In a full basement, you might have an enclosed stairway with a door at the top behind the kitchen. If you hit the jackpot, you might find a door at the bottom. 24 years in the fire service, haven't hit the jackpot yet. I know they're out there, but unfortunately, those aren't the cellar fires or the basement fires that I have. So you can actually spot it from the outside. Be aware of the what they used to refer to as the English basement or the walkout basement in the back, where it's grade level in the front and fully accessible in the rear. I believe Nick was talking about that one before. Do your 360. If you can get through the back on a full grade basement, on a walkout basement, do it. Get through the back.
And that comes into play also with, you know, the amount of height above grade that the basement is, because the amount of stairs now it takes to get to the first floor. Is a full flight of stairs to the first floor, so what is really the first floor? Or Division One, as you know, we're supposed to say Division, right? Floor is a floor, right? So sometimes people will even calculate that one, like Mike just said and Nick talked about, that offset structure, that's, you know, four stories in the rear and only two stories in the front. Now you get the confusion, like down on Bryson Street, Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah.
Right? People weren't sure what floor we're operating on. You have to identify those floor numbers quickly.
I know we talked about size up here, and it's key. The other thing is, if your fire departments do building inspections, it gives us an opportunity to get into some of these structures and see what they're like. In the city where I'm from, some of our older downtown buildings are like catacombs in the basements when you get in there or down in their cellars. You know, you gotta, if you don't have the road map when you go down there, it's very easy to get yourself lost and turned around. Other things with some of the older buildings are sub-cellars. You're going to go down into the cellar, and then you're going to go into a sub-cellar even. So those pose even more hazards when we talk about cellar fires or basement fires.
What you're saying there, Russ, is I talk about it in one of the classes I teach is those people who do EMS in their fire departments get an extra advantage of knowing the buildings in their community. Rather than my department, we don't do any EMS. We don't get into a lot of the buildings that the EMTs in the fire service too. When they see things, they need to bring that stuff back.
Yeah, I tell my crew all the time when we go out to those EMS calls, I say, it's an opportunity. The door has been opened into those people's homes or businesses to snoop around. I'm not saying you got the free will to run all over the house, but when you're in there, just start looking around what the layout of that house is, where the kitchen's located, where the interior stairs are located, because usually those homes in the neighborhood were all built around the same time, and each one is pretty much laid out the same. So, yeah, there's opportunities there for us. You might come back in another week for the kitchen fire versus this week
that's
you're there for the heart attack.
That's when you find out you have a common basement that's a block long.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
How you doing? In our district, mainly residential, we found the same thing. A lot of sometimes day labor is a thing of that nature. And what we got to report was the buildings department, private residential area, built houses, and all of a sudden we hit there, we might get something as simple as a CO alarm or something, or put on a stove, and as we're doing it, as we're going to it, it's just a simple call. And if we notice something like that, we call the buildings department, because now they're going to have access to going in, maybe find a homeowner and things of that nature. We've had that a couple of times. So that's one of the things we got a good report with as our town buildings department. And we're hand in hand, and they're very good with us. They tell us, call, you know, if you go to a call, give me something mine, doesn't have to be working fire. You see something not right, it's just people's house, call.
Yeah, most codes are written so that usually they're really stringent on whether or not you can have living space or occupancies in basements or cellars. So
it's ironic.
We have a lot of them where we have illegal.
We actually condemned a house for that reason on a CO alarm. The vent that installed a new installed a new furnace in the cellar, which was only 5 feet high, but the vent, they ran straight off the machine and never vented it to the outside. And right above where the furnace was one of the vents into the dining room. So every time she turned the heat on, the CO alarm would go off. So we actually wound up condemning the house. And that was about a 110-year-old house. That was an old post and girt house, one of the few houses that we have of that age. But we wound up condemning it. They couldn't even stay in it.
Yes, sir.
We just passed an ordinance in the city of Englewood dealing with residential lightweight truss construction. In New Jersey, our fire code, we had the Hackensack Ford fire. After the Hackensack Ford fire, the fire code, they regulated commercial buildings, so we have a placard on the outside to identify all commercial truss buildings. We took it a step further in Englewood in the last several months because we wanted to protect our firefighters a little bit better. What we did is we passed an ordinance that stipulates a truss sign or a sign identifying a residential structure, any residential structure that has lightweight building components, or any renovation that takes place in any one of a private dwelling. We have a truss sign on the outside to the right of the front door. So every time we go to that building or when we pull up to that building, if we have any question whether or not it's lightweight construction, it's identified on the outside for our firefighters to see before they enter.
Who's responsible for making sure that gets marked?
The fire department, the fire prevention bureau, and the building department, because we have a good rapport with our building department. So they'll get plans for construction or renovation, and they'll let us know. We buy the signs free, and the ordinance stipulates that they have to put it on the building.
Is there private dwellings
private
as well?
Private dwellings, Russ. Wow. And it's several departments in our area have adopted the same ordinances. We felt that it was the best way that we can identify those buildings and give our guys a better chance of surviving if they do have fires.
That's huge. Huge. Any other questions? One more, yeah?
Last year here at the show, my district, we went downstairs and the vice came out, I think it's called the Fit 5, and we actually had a basement fire where it was in the rear of the house, guys over in the basement had a problem getting to the fire, and we actually used it, it worked. Not bad, so.
They do have a purpose. They do have a purpose. They're not gonna put us out of a job.
No.
You know. I've done some R&D with the company that did that up with the other one, not the Fit 5, the one, is that the grenade one?
We've done some
R&D with the other one, like the grenade, and they do work well until, certain conditions for ventilation or other things, but to hold a fire like that, that's great. Cock it off the basement, something not ventilated yet,
it
has a purpose.
Don't bring that around us, though. But you know, really, it's a tool, and I got to tell you, I'm old school. Give me the hand line.
Right.
But I have to say that I've seen it work. You still have to get into the building because the fire is going to regenerate itself.
Right. This particular fire, like I said, the line was in the building.
Yeah.
It was in the basement, and when we did a 360, the fire was in the rear of the basement. So we can see it. The problem is, they had so much stuff downstairs, the guys had a problem getting to it,
sure.
And then they started running out of air. So, okay, well, we got to do something. We got it. Let's use it. And it darkened down enough for them to get to it and to get out the basement safely.
Yeah.
So, you know, I understand. Same thing, but at the end of the day, I get my guys out safely.
That's it. Everyone goes home.
Yeah.
That's key.
Well, we're talking about everyone goes home. Let's talk some of the inherent dangers that are confronting us as we fight fires in the basements and cellars, and some of them that readily come to mind are, we talked about earlier, was the ventilation. Obviously, we have a situation where we're not being able to ventilate, so we are going to have extreme heat buildup in the basement areas. The conditions are going to be a lot more severe for us. It's going to be a lot darker down there because the smoke is not going to lighten up. There's no windows to let light in, so we will really have a hard time knowing whether or not we're being effective with our streams, too. Also, I'd like to talk a little bit about the delay in alarms. And, Dave, do you have problems in your area with the delays?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the last major fire I had in Danbury before we moved, the downtown Danbury was built around Civil War days. And there was a furniture store downtown, Bernardino's. Now, they kept buying buildings on both sides of them and knocking holes. And they had about four of these buildings in the basement. And we got an alarm one night, and it was a smoke alarm in the CVS drugstore, which was actually two doors down. And the smoke had to seep through all the two other occupied buildings to get into the CVS where it kicked off the smoke alarm. And, of course, that fire was totally involved. As I said, there was no saving that building. And, and even people sleeping up above the fire. We had a fire in a neighboring community. It came in as a smoke alarm in the upstairs hallway. and they had two doors going to the basement. They had a hell of a working basement fire, but it came in as a smoke alarm in the upstairs hallway, and when the first company got there, the fire had already burned through the front door. It burned through the two stairs, and there was a case where I don't know why they didn't put smoke detectors in the basement. We never did figure that out. But the delayed alarm in both of those cases just required defensive tactics.
Nick, you were mentioning earlier you've had problems with the fatalities with your firefighters because of basement fires. Mm-hmm. Delay of alarms have any effect on that?
Not really to my knowledge. I mean, it seems like in these days everybody's got, we're in a city environment and everybody's got a cell phone. So it's funny, sometimes you sit in the firehouse and you can actually see the calls pop up on the CAD screen in the firehouse and you'll know it's a fire because it'll pop up 5 times in a row. You know, now how long it took for somebody to see that outward sign and call it in, you can never really be sure. But I mean, one of the things we run into, and it's kind of alluded to earlier, is a lot of these Collier style mansion conditions. And before I worked in DC, I worked in Fairfax, which is a pretty affluent suburb in Northern Virginia, and that's a multi-million dollar home kind of stuff there. And I've seen it, the rich people do crazy stuff and the poor people do crazy stuff, and you sometimes never know who's going to have the greater fire load in their basement or in the rest of their house. And so sometimes, even though it might not be a delayed alarm, we pulled up on fires at noon and it's blowing out 3 windows and you're like, how did it get this far? And then you get at 3 a.m, you get a smoke investigation. You're like, wow, that could have been something if somebody hadn't noticed it. So it seems to kind of go back and forth, I guess.
And basement fires, obviously, you can have a basement fire start and get progressing going real well there without it being detected from the outside because, again, we talked about lack of windows. Somebody's walking by, they're not obviously seeing any fire or seeing any smoke because it hasn't found a way to get out of the basement yet.
And on that, Russ, if I can just add real quick, that brings to mind a fire that we had in Northwest Washington, and I remember listening to the dispatch audio respond for fire coming from the roof of this reported address. And they get there, and sure enough, it was. But just like we've kind of talked about, you kind of have to assume that fire is always on the lower floor until you keep going down and you run out of, and you make sure that lower floor doesn't have fire. And basically what had happened was, it was a basement fire and it burned up all through the inside of the house. But what the scary thing that brings to mind is this kind of moth to candle syndrome. There was a similar fire in Loudoun County, Virginia, maybe a year or two ago, and it wasn't necessarily a basement fire, but it was actually a first floor fire, but they pulled up and had fire blowing out of the cockwall, moth to candle up to the cockwall fire. That's certainly on fire. But what had happened was a grill on an outside deck off the first floor had lit off, went up the siding and went into the cockwall, produced the visible fire, but at the same time busted out the sliding glass windows on the first floor and started taking possession of the first and second floors beneath them as they were fighting the fire on the top floor, and it ended up, of course, in a near-miss bailout kind of scenario. So, I think you really have to be careful about that. Again, from the size-up perspective, it's all about figuring out what's going on before we can figure out what to do about it. And, until you figure out the fire is not below you, you have to assume that it is.
Right. The other area I want to touch on briefly, too, is some of the hazards that we can find in our cellar or basements in fire storage goes. A lot of people, I know I'm probably just as bad as everybody else because I have paint in my basement because my wife seems to always find chores for me around the house for painting, and I never get to use the full gallon up. It's not as bad today as it used to be when I was growing up because years ago we used to deal a lot with oil-based paint, so you always had thinners and to clean the brushes with. Nowadays everything's a latex, a little soap and water is fine, but we still have these situations and problems, and it brings back to my mind, I lost a very good friend of mine in New York because they had a fire in a hardware store, and because of the products that they were storing in the basement, they had an explosion there, and my best friend from New York got killed in that fire that day. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the different hazards that we can see. I know some of the other ones that I see in private dwellings is people that want to, they've got these beautiful Harley Davidsons or something, and they, in the winter months, they don't want to see them get Yeah, it's, they're like a good cigar. They got to make sure the humidity and everything is perfect around that bike. So they bring them into the basements, but they don't drain the gasoline out of them.
Or they clean the carburetors and do all the work on it.
Exactly. So I'd like the panel to touch a little bit on some of the other hazards that we may come across from time to time in situations like that. So,
we keep going back to the residential property. And, you know, you think about how easy is it for me to call two guys from the firehouse and say, hey, you want to come over? I got to run to Home Depot, pick up some lumber and some paneling and frame out a quick room in the basement. You know, by Monday morning, crazy Aunt Janie's living in my basement. You know, that's really not hard to do. And doesn't give us any information from the firefighter and the, you know, civilian accountability. But you also have those basement home businesses that you find in people's basements, you know, some home catering businesses. So there was a property in Vineland, New Jersey, where there was a commercial print shop in the basement where they almost lost a couple of firefighters. And you know, you just don't know that that's in the basement of a residential property unless we get in there. Unfortunately, the only time they got in there was when the building was on fire. And a lot of stuff, a lot of the cables and wiring came down from the ceiling on his members. That stuff and just the ductwork, you know, again, whether the ceiling is exposed or enclosed in the basement creates a bigger problem. We don't know those things.
You know, the other clue that I usually pick up when there's going to be a bad day, I look in the driveway. I mean, I see a van for a plumber supply. I see a van for pool supply. I see a painter. And believe me, I'm not picking on any trade, but you know what? These guys work out of their vehicles, or they work out of their homes. And where do they store a lot of the equipment that they need to do their jobs? Yeah, in this basement or in the cellar. You know, and so really, you know, those kind of clues that you can pick up in the driveway or see these vehicles out on the road, that should be a big red light to you. You know, it's probably going to have something related to that inside that house somewhere. So you should really stay sharp on that. You know, take a good look at everything that's going around.
You know, out in the country, we get drug activity. So we had a meth lab in the basement, and there was no fire involved, but we had a meth lab in the basement, and then as in that coal rain fire, they had a pot growing operation down there. So there's electric wires strung all over and tangled.
That was also a factor in fire, but that's in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, the overgrown marijuana.
Mm-hmm. We had one where we were too. You know how they got caught? They were actually burning the stems, and one of the cops drove by and smelt it. Real entrepreneur, let me tell you. Yeah.
Well, it brings up another important thing when we talk about safety. We are seeing more and more of these drug labs being. I mean, our drug dealers are getting more and more brassy when they talk about taking over areas. Look at what's going on in Mexico. But we are seeing a lot more of these growing pot. We see a lot more of the chemicals being used to make synthetic drugs and stuff to sell to the street people. But these people take those jobs seriously, and they try to protect themselves. And in some of those operations, they booby-trap these properties. And they have some of the sophisticated monitoring equipment and everything. And if they think they hear something going on or they feel that they're about to be busted or something, they're going to activate their booby traps and they're going to get the heck out of there. And that poses a huge problem for firefighters. And a lot of these things are in basements or cellars because they can conceal them easily enough. And now we get the buildup of these chemicals reacting with one another, and we have a real serious situation going on down there too. So it's definitely different. Hey, Nick, you got anything you want to add there about the...
Well, I mean, I guess to kind of put the cart before a horse a little, I already told this a little bit of the story about that one in C-Plus in Maryland, but obviously the big thing there was that gas main. You know, a lot of the times the gas meter is on the outside of the house. In this case, it was inside of the basement. It was, you know, PVC piping, and that played a direct role in how hellacious that fire got. And, you know, nobody could know at the time that the gas shuttle-off was in the street, like basically kind of underneath one of the first two engines. You know, and nobody would have thought of that at the time until after, but just something to kind of, you know, a lot of the things we've been talking about is when are we going to figure things out? You know, when we pull up on the front lawn or beforehand, and all of it comes in the district familiarization. I know it's not glorious, it's not exciting, but, you know, there's nothing better you can do to prepare for a fire than to get out and look at your area and see where, you know, how the new development of houses is being built and where the steps are in that place, and go into the old buildings downtown and figure out what they're doing with them and how you would access certain things and what is stored in different places, using the nuisance alarms, like we talked about, as a learning opportunity. And then, you know, also taking that and developing our tactics ahead of time so that when we get there, it's not a front lawn huddle trying to figure out what is it we're going to do. We've got plan A, B, C, D, et cetera. But, I mean, on the, you know, it's just something to remember. You never know what's going to be in a basement. We've already kind of covered it. Could be every, you know, a lot of people want to discount it right away and say, oh, that's utilities and storage. Well, we've all got a story, I'm sure, about residential living in the basements. You know, so we know it could contain anything from, you know, grandma's, you know, living in the basement now to all of the stuff somebody didn't want to see. Their old paint cans, the electric room, the utility room, the furnace, all that stuff. So, I mean, we have to bear in mind that it could be any one of those things, and unless you've personally been in that basement before the fire, you're not going to know until afterwards what it actually was.
I don't like to tell a lot of those kind of stories, but you talk about the different things you can run into in a basement and everything. We had a fire years ago, and I was probably 4 or 5 years on the job. We had a fire in a funeral home. That's a strange feeling when you're in the basement and you find a body down there that's on their table being prepared for...
make the grip?
No. But those are other things. There's lots of chemicals that are kept there at the funeral home for embalming of the bodies and stuff. Again, it's knowing what's out there, and there's different situations. Obviously, we're not going to know everything we're going to be up against, but knowing a good amount of it, the things that are routine that we run into on a daily basis, we should be boning up on. Any other questions for the panel right now before we go any further? Yes, sir.
Used to be we looked at 12 to 15 minutes until we gave up. Still that long?
That's
how we switch between jurisdictions.
Absolutely. Well, go ahead, Chief. No, go ahead.
Yeah, the old adage was, you know, 20 minutes, things aren't working, you go to plan B. It's out the door, obviously, now. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, with today's construction, and, you know, we don't want to focus on lightweight construction, but this is our world today. You know, there's still many buildings out there that you can be within the building for 20 minutes. It's not a problem. But we have to say to ourselves, 20 minutes is no longer that way. You know, when we teach, we also teach 20 minutes from when? From the time you arrive or from the time that you get dispatched? Because some people take maybe a 10-minute response to get to some locations. So you have to factor in all that lead time into your, you know, fire ground size of plan when you arrive.
And so, if I might, Chief, jump in real quick, that's going to fall back again on knowing your district, knowing your construction type, and... Again, we're talking basement fires here, cellar fires. How long of a delay before it was noticed? And that could be huge.
Yeah, there's a lot of lead time.
The studies that were just done in Chicago, if you read about that, within 6 minutes of lightweight construction, the floors were failing. So, you know, before you may even arrive in the scene, that floor may have already failed. So 20 minutes is no longer an effective measure.
Or us going through there, creating that impact load on the floor. Cause that collapse.
Mm. Well, if I can jump in kind of on that, I think two fires come to mind as soon as you ask that question. And it makes me say that a lot of it's dependent on occupancy. And again, we have to have multiple plans ahead of time. One of the fires actually ended up being the largest fire in D.C. in something like 35 years. And it was in a 4-story brick occupied apartment building at midnight. And unbeknownst to us, this fire had been going in the basement. I mean, it could have been hours before somebody talked about delayed alarm until somebody figured it out. And, you know, when we got there, we thought it was on the second floor. It was on the second floor, but it was also on the first floor in the basement. It turns out through the walls, pretty much up to the roof. But basically, this occupied apartment building had something like 200 occupants in it, half of, you know, almost all of them asleep. So that was really a scenario where we had to stick it out for a while, I mean, to affect the civilian rescues. And it was a very tough fire, and it ended up, the building ended up collapsing at the end of the day. But I mean, you know, with the amount of civilians that were in there, I mean, it had to be held in check until those rescues could be effective. Another one is was a middle of the row, a 3-story middle of the row row house, and the fire was well progressed through the basement. And our primary go-to attack tactic is first line, hold the steps. We have those English basements, a lot of them. If not, there's usually a rear. And the second line will go in the exterior entrance and attack it much like a first floor fire, which is nice and easy. Our big concern in basements is quite obviously falling through the first floor as we're doing some particular task. Well, at this fire, three stories, it's been going real good in the basement. You know, they couldn't even get in past the threshold of the front door because the floor was that far going on the first floor. That's soggy. Again, middle of the night type fire, had two victims trapped on the upper floor, and it would have been very easy there to, you know, based on some risk analysis or whatever, abandon ship, for lack of a better term. But I think the guys made a much better choice in that the first line, instead of saying, oh, we can't make it to the actual basement steps, we'll give up, they stood at the threshold of the door on the porch and knocked down what they, you know, put it on a straight stream and knocked down what they could from where they were, and were able to protect the interior steps enough for the truck and the rescue to VES the second floor and perform the rescues. So, I mean, and about at the same time, the other line, the second line's in the rear at the basement entrance, knocking down the fire. And they were able to prevent it from extending to the adjacent rows and make the rescues while modifying the tactic slightly. So, you know, we all know what an offense, you know, there's going in and there's staying out, but there is a middle ground too that can be adapted, you know, when it needs to be based on the conditions and what we got going on.
Yeah, I think in the size of, you know, we'll go back again, the size of, I think nowadays it's more important that the size up has to be dynamic. It changes. And you have to keep watching the fire. You have to watch the smoke. You have to see what's going on. And then as companies come in, instead of having them stand there, get them to stretch another line. Get them, you know, give me 200 feet of 2.5 right here and get ready to operate it. In other words, so when you decide that, man, it ain't working, let's do it, you can do it right away. And, you know, calling for the help on time, before you... back in Chicago when I would ride there, it's like, well, let's get some water on the fire first before we box this thing. And in many cases that worked. Nowadays, no, we're gonna get the help coming now. You know, so it's a dynamic, and I think nowadays it's so much more important that whoever's in charge of that fire, it's changing all the time. You've really got to be good. You've got to watch and get some eyes around behind that building too if you have to.
In 2008, New Jersey adopted several regulations, and one of them was incident timekeeping. So it's a regulation that every 10 to 15 minutes, the dispatch desk is supposed to notify the incident commander of that time, that 10 to 15 minute time period, because that gives him a good idea of how long he's been there, if things are working, if he needs to go to plan B. So it might be something that you might want to write into your SOG, where you have your dispatch center notify the incident commander every so often, so that way he has a good idea of exactly. Because as you well know, you're in charge of a fire, you lose track of all time.
Yeah, we've got that in our job, Bob. Every 20 minutes, the dispatcher will give the incident commander a heads up that you're at your first 20-minute mark, you're at your second 20-minute mark. And we've gone so far as to also say that when you're notified at that first 20-minute mark, it's an indicator to that incident commander that he ought to start thinking about conducting the first PAR. Yeah, it's not mandatory, but it's a highly recommended that he does. At a 30-minute mark, though, it is mandatory that we conduct the first PAR, and just for accountability purposes, because we are utilizing our firefighters more. They're doing more work than they used to before because of manpower problems, and it's easy to lose track of your firefighters, and if they have radio problems, or in our department, it seems like we're switching back and forth from frequency to frequency, and it's easy to be on the wrong frequency to call a mayday, and you might not be heard on the fire scene. Yeah, I saw a question.
Just a tip, I know a lot of people have talked about it, but a lot of incident commanders never carry stopwatches. You know, I'll be honest with you, where I work, communications is the center for, and we're lucky to get a 20-minute PAR check, you know, when we're supposed to do it, because, you know, 9 times out of 10 at 2 o'clock in the morning, there's only one of them working. You know, she's trying to manage 2 EMS calls before we're working fire. And, you know, oh, by the way, it's, you know, you're 30 minutes. I missed the last 10-minute, you know, PAR check. So, you know, it's kind of one of those unfortunate things that, you know, you're in command of a fire. Don't wait for communication to call you. If you want to call someone 10 minutes into a fire, kind of like what, you know, going back to what you said about, is it 20 minutes or 10 minutes? Well, it's, you know, whenever you want to check, more or less, you know. So I don't think anybody should wait for that 20-minute PAR check or whatever. Mm-hmm. If you feel like you need to check 5 minutes or 10 minutes into a progress report, you know, don't bug the guy that's working, but at the same time, you need to kind of use common sense and say, you know what, this is pretty significant, I just, you know, should probably, you know, do this in 10 or whatever. So.
And if you think about it, as the incident commander, ultimately you are the responsible one. So.
And Russ, one that, you know, it's a lot of times we talk about like the 20-minute thing, which I think is a good thing, it's becoming kind of a national thing. we think about it a lot in terms of bad things. Is it time to transition from offensive to defensive because things aren't going well? Or, you know, is it time to do an accountability trek so we're not missing somebody? But also, we got to remember that things could be going well, but also at the 20-minute indicator, that's a good time to think from, you know, as a work time perspective, that it's going to be time very quickly, if not now, to swap out Cruz. And I feel like that's another thing that, like, everybody's like, oh, wait, we got to change out Cruz, and then everybody's got to put down what they're doing, make some type of personnel exchange, and by the time the new personnel get back in there, the progress that has been made has been lost, and we just went from winning the game to losing the game. You know, whereas if kind of like Dave was saying, the next team is already there, ready to go, they can come in and relieve the crew on the line, so the Fire, you know, or relieve the guys on the hooks, so the firefight doesn't stop while we're exchanging for air purposes.
Yeah, I try to tell guys when I'm teaching too, and is that as an incident commander, when you first got there and you're in your size up, if for whatever reason the thought went through your mind real quickly that, you know, this fire has the potential of going to a second alarm, that's the time to call it. It's not to wait 5 more minutes and then say, you know, it's got to the second alarm, I better call for it. No, if you had that thought, that's the time you need to be calling for additional resources, because remember, there's a time factor and a delay in those responses getting there as well, and we want to make sure that they get there when you're going to need them, not 10 minutes after you've already needed them. And so if you have that thought, call for them. It's easy enough to put them in a staging area if you're not going to utilize them right away, and it's also easy enough to turn them around and send them back if you get lucky and get your hands around that situation.
Yeah, that's a good point that you bring up there, Russ. Because, as you said, your cues, the things that you're seeing on fire ground, are going to tell you, yeah, this is going to be a second alarm, or we can make a quick knock on this. And we teach the same way. I teach it with Maydays. If you think you have a problem, you have a problem. Say it. You can always cancel your Mayday, but call that you have that problem. Same thing. You think you need a second alarm? Call it. You can always say, hey, guys, thanks for coming. Yeah, break my chops at dinner, but later. But, you know, all right. But I was looking out for my guys inside the building.
Exactly right.
When I teach some of the other things is that, you know, you make your size up, you get the companies working, and I always try to stop and think, if I do nothing, what's this place going to look like in 20 minutes? And if I'm thinking, God, there'll be fire out every window, it'll be up in the attic, that's when I go to the second alarm, because, I mean, I'm thinking of the potential. What if they can't? What if the inside's cut up? Or what if they're in one apartment and it's all walled off and they can't get to where the fire is? So I always kind of think, what's going to happen in 20 minutes if I do nothing? And if it looks like it's going to be one hell of a fire, then I'll usually go ahead and start getting companies coming in, like we were saying, and, you know, get them moving.
Any other questions from our audience? If I don't have any other questions, what I'd like to do at this time is just do a quick rundown through here, have everybody just give their final thoughts, and then I'll wrap up here with some closing thoughts that I have here, and we'll wrap this thing up, and you can go and get to the next class or see some of the floor down below there, or speak to some of the instructors here, ask them if you've got some personal things you want to talk about. But, John, why don't you kick us off?
Okay. Well, first, again, I'd like to thank everybody for coming. It's great that we're sharing this information. As I said to Art here in front row, why keep it to yourself? You know, Loudoun County did a great job when they had that incident, and they got it out and came across the internet, and people, firefighters, learned from it, hopefully learned from it. If you know something, don't be the only one that knows it, share it. You know, basement fires are hazardous.
And, you know, you bring that up, and it reminds me of sharing your information. I can remember the first time I saw any fire department decide that they wanted to share information so that a firefighter didn't get hurt again, and that was when Chief Dickinson was the chief of Pittsburgh, and they had the Bryson Street fire.
Yeah.
He went right on and broadcast it out, and he even made the comment then. He says, I know that the lawyers are out there, and they're probably just biting at the bit because I'm giving them information to fight their battle with, but I just don't want to see another firefighter get killed. And I thought that was very courageous on his behalf. And we're starting to see more and more chief officers say, hey, look, here's what happened in our department. We don't want to have it happen again. And they're broadcasting our errors. And it takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of strength and conviction to do that. But it's through those things that firefighters' lives are saved. And that's primarily what we're all about, saving lives.
No, that's exactly where I was going with this. You know, this is a great opportunity for us to share with you. Please, Russ has asked before, if you have a question, don't hesitate to ask. But as we said, basement fires, we know, are inherently dangerous. I was talking with Mike last night, and I'm a statistical kind of guy. I do a lot of research. My wife thinks I'm crazy, but stuff falls around the back of my head. I mean, since the Wonder Drug fire in New York City that killed 12 firefighters in a basement fire, there's been 82 line of duty deaths that I've researched so far. I picked up a couple more today that we've talked about where firefighters have gotten killed, and only 42 incidents, 85 firefighters have gotten killed. So we have to think how dangerous this is. But yeah, it's over almost a 30-year period. But so these things are happening constantly. With the advent of the internet, it's great to know what's going on. I can find out what happened in Rochester this morning because of the internet and know about it, pass that information along. It used to be, well, 3 months later, it came out in Firehouse Magazine, you learned about it. But what did we miss in that 3 month period? So just stay on top of your game and pay attention that size of it is the most important thing you can do on your fire ground. Know your buildings.
Bob?
I have to agree with John. You know, if you look at any NIOSH report on firefighter fatalities or injuries, what's one of the first things you read in almost every report is improper and ineffective size of his gun's arrival. So it becomes very, very important to know what you're getting yourself into. 12 years as chief, I've been in charge of a lot of basement fires, I've been in charge of a lot of fires. They are inherently the most dangerous fire that you're going to be involved in. So you're here today to prepare for that, and I give you a lot of credit. Just make sure that you keep up on things that are out there and make sure you keep you guys safe. One thing I want to say, and I mentioned it earlier, I talk about air management. And the reason why I talk about air management is because in a fire in a building, when you have a fire in a low-grade area, you put your mask on from the time you walk in the door, typically. You're on air that entire time. When we almost lost our three firefighters, the key factor to this, and we've all done it, everybody in the room probably, is when your low air alarm goes off, what do? We stay in the building, don't we? Or we have, I have, too many times. And I'm sure everybody in the room, that was the one deciding factor in why we almost lost those people, because they didn't pay attention to their air. John and I do a lot of teaching with the Seattle guys. They're very good, and we've picked up a lot from them. But it's very, very important air management. And again, I know from my experience in almost losing those guys, and I'm very honest, Russ, I travel around the country, and I say when I'm wrong and when I'm right. You know, I have no problem doing that. And that's one of the things I think that makes a department better, and you better, by recognizing some of the faults you may have, or some things you might not have done right, and then, you know, try to recover from that. So I give you credit for being here, and thanks for listening.
And I'm going to add on to what you just said there, too, Bob, having the credit to say or the courage to say, hey, I made a mistake in that. The other thing I like to tell people, too, is that I'm no better than you are. I'm just a firefighter. I've come through. I've picked up a lot of things over the years. I've forgotten a lot of things over the years, and that's why I'll continue to go to training seminars and things because people ask, why do you go to that? You know everything. Well, yeah, I might have known something at one time. I might have forgotten it. And it's good to hear somebody else's opinion on it because it brings back things that are in the back of the mind. Computers are great things. You hit the enter button. It's supposed to bring stuff to your screen. I haven't got an enter button in my brain that can bring something that's in the back of my brain to the front. But when I hear people talking about it, it helps bring it back, and it's great. And I'll be one of the first ones that will also say that I don't have all the answers, but through networking, through meeting people on this panel and others, they're just a phone call or an email away, and hey, have you ever had this situation? And if so, what did you do? How did you handle it? And you just need to know where to go to get the answers. So hopefully we're giving some information here today that's going to help you with some of those answers. And Nick?
I think just sum up some tactic things. I think the two primary problems with basement fires are lack of recognition and not knowing what to do once you figure it out. And I've seen that happen in other departments, and I've seen it happen at fires that I've been to. And, you know, size up, you have to do a 360, however it is that you do it, and you have to do a basement check. You have to physically put somebody in the basement and have them tell the incident commander the basement is clear or the basement's on fire. It only takes a second, and it can prevent a whole lot of these problems. As far as tactics go, you have to have the plan set out ahead of time. Everybody's comfortable with first four fires, second four fires, all that stuff, because it's right in front of us and it's easy to get to. With these fires, you know, the things that we've talked about this morning, if you take the factors of how many personnel do I have, so how many hand lines can I put in place, is there or isn't there an exterior entrance, and what is the tenability of the first floor, then we can very clearly establish our a hierarchy of what we would prefer to do. And we have plans A, B, C, and D, and everybody in the fire department from firefighter, private, to battalion chief and above, know what those plans are. So there's no, what are we doing? What should we do in this scenario? Oh, there's not a basement entrance. There's no confusion. When that confusion happens, that's when people get hurt, and that's when we burn buildings down that didn't have to. So, you know, we got to recognize what we have through a 360 and a basement check, and we have to have more than one plan of action. So many departments, the plan of action is go down the steps. And I'm telling you, on a good basement fire, that's not going to be an option. So you got to ask yourself, what's next? And the time to figure that out is not on the front lawn of the fire. It's around the kitchen table or during our district familiarizations or any other time before the fire.
You know, I agree, and I'm glad we're all here because none of us have ever been at the same fire, and we're sharing all of our experiences with you. I too, like John, I like looking. I dissect fatality reports. Again, the Briceland Street fire, tremendously telling when those people died there. New York City does a tremendous job on their line of duty deaths. And one of the things that I see recurring, no matter where the fire is, most of the time there's a problem with water. They didn't get the water. They didn't apply enough water. Something happened. The water wasn't where it needed to be. And one of the things that I emphasize, of course, being an engine type guy, is that first floor and below, New York City, it's got to be a 2.5. And if you're not used to taking a 2.5 down a cellar stairs and making a turn, boy, it's a good time to start doing it on the drills. And it's something, you know, the 2.5, oh, yeah, that's that thing up there with the handles on it. Yeah, we used that a couple years ago, remember? But I have what I call my theory of recency. If you haven't used it recently, you forget it's there. But if you're going to get serious about fighting basement fires, you're going to need to put water on them. Delayed alarms, unknown contents, the fire's attacking the structure, you're going to need some big water, and you're going to have to know how to use it. If you haven't used that distributor nozzle, get that thing out and try it. You know, because that is also with what everybody said, like Nick, as far as sizing up, having a plan, you're going to have to use a lot of water on this thing. And boy, you're going to really need to get back to basics and move that water in that basement.
Yeah.
I'm going to stick with my 6 points of success before that happened at every fire. Incident command, forcible entry, search and rescue, getting water, ventilation, and Rick. You have to do them all. And if you're not bringing enough people to the event to do it, something's not getting done and somebody's going to get hurt. It's up to you to figure out how to do it, whether it's through automatic aid or mutual aid or multiple alarms. I can tell you that it's very rare that I'll stop at a second alarm. I usually like to have a tactical reserve of at least two companies, an engine and a truck standing behind me. So if I turn around and I need something done, I don't have that reflex time to get somebody there. So don't be afraid to hit multiple alarms at a fire like this so you know that everything that you need to get done is getting done.
Okay, and I'm just going to finish up here with some of the things that we've hit here on today as a panel. Size up was a key, and size up is the key to success. If you're doing a good size up, you're gathering data to be able to make decisions on, and those decisions are going to have to be implemented in your incident action plans. So size up, we've talked about here. We talk about the construction of our buildings, knowing the difference in them. Again, we talk about the different construction here where we can be with John, and we've got time because he's under the conventional construction, where when we're with Mike, we're against the clock because everything there is more of the lightweight construction, so having a good understanding of our construction. Another area we talk about was manpower, and you've heard us on the panel here say that if you don't have the manpower, start getting it there. Mike likes to have staged resources, and that's great, and I think that's a key element to our success as well, is put a staging area there and have a full assignment sitting in there staging. If you start deploying those resources, backfill them. But they're closer by. They're within usually 2 to 3 minutes of getting on location when they're staged versus 15 minutes of getting on location from their firehouses. I know a lot of departments around where I live in the county, they'll call up and say, have the next fire department over stage in quarters because they don't want to bring their apparatus out of their own jurisdiction into their firehouses, so they have them stage in quarters. but it's still a good 15-minute ride sometimes from their firehouse to get to your incident scene. So, and the other one, other than size up, that I think is very important is district familiarization. Know what's out there in your district and what's going on in your areas. Are we talking about residential areas? Are we talking about industrial areas? Are we talking about business establishments? Are we able to get into our buildings and do building inspections and see what kind of conditions, what's the housekeeping like? Even in private dwellings, I've gone into people's homes that are pack rats, and you're like going through the front door and you got to follow this maze to get to the kitchen because stuff is piled up in bags and from the floors to the ceiling. You can't get through them. We mentioned about access to private dwellings through our EMS system and getting in. It gives us an opportunity to see what kind of conditions we're up against. But our building inspections gets us into the commercial end of it, and we can see what kind of storage, the layouts, the problems, the situations that we can have if we're at any of those. So in closing, what I would like to do is I would like to thank the panel for being here today and sharing their information that they've gathered over their years of success in the business. I would like to thank our attenders, our audience here for attending and having your input and questions. I hope we've been able to answer some of them successfully. If not, we're going to be around for a while, or you'll see us out on the floor or in the halls. Just corner us and pin us down for some more questions if you'd like to. And I'd also like to take this time to thank Peter Matthews and the people at Firehouse and Firehouse.com for giving us this opportunity to come to Baltimore and be a part of future training in the fire service. So with that, panel, thank you. And audience, thank you.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.